It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM, WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbert. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
But I think it's more than that. It's manipulation and control to dominate someone. And it's particularly heinous when it's an intimate partner, someone that you love, who loves you, with you, whom you have children, with you, whom you have a long history of an intimate relationship.
Attorney Sushila Varkey talks about domestic violence, its impact on society, and the legal protections available to survivors. And if you've ever wondered what to do if your bank account gets garnished, you'll find out in our question and answer session. All that and more coming up. Stay tuned with us. This show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. A free public education should be free. But last month, a study by the Just Children program in Charlottesville found many schools charge for science labs, gym uniforms, art supplies, class picnics, and other student activities. Some parents pay hundreds of dollars in annual fees, even though Virginia's Constitution guarantees a free public education. School fees got attention when a single mother of three Roanoke County students contacted Legal Aid after taking out a car title loan to pay the $195 the school was charging her. Once the Legal Aid Society of Roanoke Valley met with the school system, the fees were scrapped, and the county took up the cost of almost $427,000. In the Richmond area, similar fees have yet to be scrapped. In other news, former West Virginia Supreme Court Justice Richard Neely recently described his role as an arbitrator for the National Arbitration Forum as, quote, set up to squeeze small sums of money out of desperately poor people. Arbitration takes away the right to have disputes heard by a court and forces consumers into arbitration firms selected by corporations. In an expose by Business Week, Neely and other former arbitrators describe a system completely stacked against consumers, where creditors win 99.8% of all arbitrations. Neely said, quote, the National Arbitration Forum is nothing more than an arm of the collection industry, hiding behind a veneer of impartiality. Although states can't ban arbitration, they can reform it by requiring disclosure of decisions and by limiting fees. Such reform efforts have not yet been introduced in Virginia. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's independent radio.
This week's legal term of the week is protective order. A protective order is an order telling a spouse, family member, or household member to stay away from you. An emergency protective order can be issued by a judge or magistrate right away and is good for only 72 hours. A preliminary protective order can be issued only by a judge after the court gives the abuser notice and a chance for a hearing, and is good for 15 days. A permanent protective order also can be issued only by a judge after the court gives the abuser notice and a chance for a hearing, but can be good for up to 2 years. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and that's this week's Legal Term of the Week.
You're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and we're the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. It's time for the weekly question and answer session, and in the studio we have a questioner. Tell us your name and where you live.
My name is Erin, and I live in Chesterfield.
Good, Erin. What is your question for this week?
My question is, recently my bank account was garnished, and my only income is through the VA benefits that I receive, child support, and part-time income.
And you want to know what you can do about that?
That's correct.
Okay, Erin, well, first of all three of those types of income are exempt from garnishment. So they could not be garnished at the source. That is, the VA benefits could not be garnished directly from the Veterans Administration. The child support could not be garnished from whoever is paying the child support. And the part-time wages could not be garnished from whoever is paying you the part-time wages. The problem is when you deposit those monies into a bank, or if they get deposited into a bank, the creditor who's trying to collect the judgment doesn't know where that money is from. All they know is that you've got some money in some bank, and they're going to have the court issue a garnishment summons. When the court issues a garnishment summons, a couple of things happen. First of all, the bank gets a copy of the garnishment summons and an instruction form that tells them what to do. You, as the judgment debtor, also get a copy of the garnishment summons, and you also get a copy of a form called a garnishment exemption claim form that you can use on your own, by yourself, without an attorney, to claim an exemption hearing, and you are entitled by Virginia law to get that within 7 days. The problem is that form is just a one-page form, and it's useful in a simple case where you have only one source of income. In your situation, you've got not just one source of income, you've got three different sources of income. And although each individual source is exempt, you have to document, first of all, where the money in the account came from, whether it was from VA or child support or wages. Then, for each of those sources, you have to document that it came from that source. So you need a letter from the VA showing that that particular amount came from the VA, some sort of child support order showing that the child support deposit was, in fact, from child support, and some sort of indication that the wages really were part-time wages, which could just be the bank account statement itself, because under Virginia law, wages of $262 per week or less after required taxes are withheld are exempt from garnishment. Actually, that figure I just gave you is going to be effective July 24th. Before that, it's $234 per week. So you see why it gets complicated, and you see why in a simple case you can use that court form, but in a more complicated case it really helps to have an attorney.
Okay, thank you.
Hang on, let it. Turn me around, no, turn me around. Ain't gonna let injustice turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up the freedom land.
This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright, and we're here at the Virginia Poverty Law Center with attorney Sushila Varkey, who focuses on domestic violence issues. Welcome to the show, Sushila.
Well, thank you, Marty. It's nice to be here.
Good. Let's start with some of the basic questions. You focus on domestic violence issues. Can you tell us briefly, from a legal standpoint, what is spouse abuse or family abuse?
Well, a lot of people think of it as physical abuse, physical injury, but I think it's more than that. It's manipulation and control to dominate someone. And it's particularly heinous when it's an intimate partner, someone that you love, who loves you, with you, whom you have children, with you, whom you have a long history of an intimate relationship. So I would say it's more about power and control than necessarily physical violence. And it can include mental and sort of emotional trauma, people undergoing long years of manipulation and sort of just escalating manipulation to the point that they don't even realize what's going on.
So there doesn't have to be an actual physical injury. What about a threat of a physical injury? Does that have to be present?
Well, when you talk about domestic violence, there's a lot of things that wouldn't be considered actionable in the legal system. So, for example, what is considered family abuse in the Code of Virginia is an act of violence, force, or threat against your family or household member, which results in bodily injury or places one in reasonable fear of some kind of bodily injury. So in here in that definition, you're talking about really an injury plus fear. And I think that is what happens when victims seek protective relief in the court system. Sometimes they may have an injury that they even show up to court with that's very obvious, like a black eye. But if they don't express a fear of their partner, they could potentially not get a protective order.
I see. Now, you mentioned the term family or household member and also the
right.
term partner. Who would, in law, be considered a family or household member against whom a victim could get a protective order?
That's a good question, because often people think, well, I have to be married to be able to seek protective relief against a family or a household member. But it could be former spouses. It could be in-laws, if your in-laws live with the respondent. It could be your children, you know, siblings. It can be anyone that you have this intimate partnership with. Usually we're talking about spouses, former spouses, or people who, and the term is cohabited. They're either cohabiting, living together as husband and wife, now or within the last 12 months, or with whom you have a child in common.
Okay. So if you were counseling a victim of domestic violence, what's the first thing that the victim should do?
The first thing, well, for me, because I'm a lawyer, usually, hopefully, the victim has gotten to someone who can help them with safety planning before they come to me. And what I mean by that is, if they have left, for most victims, leaving violence can be the most dangerous time for them. So you have to have a safety plan. That might include figuring out an alternative place to live before you actually leave your home that you share with your abusive partner. And that should be a place that he doesn't necessarily know about. If you have children, you have to think about how do I protect my children from violence that they might witness of my partner against me, and protect them as well, yet let my partner see them, especially if he has not been abusive to them. It's complicated. So there's a lot that goes into that safety planning. But frankly, for me, a lot of what I do is talk to victims over the phone. They somehow find me from the internet or from talking to advocates. And I talk through what the process will be and what to expect based on the facts they present to me.
Okay. Well, you mentioned children, and that anticipates the next question that I had in my mind was, should a victim of domestic violence leave with the children?
That's a good question. I know of cases where people haven't, where victims have left the children with the abusive party. And part of that was because their sense was, the abuse is against me. He's never been physically or otherwise abusive toward the children. So if I take myself out of this situation, it will de-escalate the violence. Things will calm down. He will be a better dad. I mean, some of this is, I think, hopeful thinking, but I have had clients who've done that. For the most part, though, the sense is that if the person is violent to you, they can be violent to your children. And frankly, there are amazing statistics that show that children who've witnessed domestic violence are actually experiencing more brain trauma than if they themselves were abused. It's amazing. I've gone to a couple of seminars where scientists are doing this research on brain function and loss of function and how to sort of reroute kids who've experienced domestic violence. So, I mean, personally, I think it is dangerous for children to watch that and to be subject to that, even if they're not harmed themselves.
That is really fascinating.
Isn't it? And I think the thing, though, is when you are leaving a partner and you have children with them, especially if they're young children, most of the victims I've talked to want, even if the partner is an abusive or partner or bad dad, they still want their partner to have an interaction with their children. They want their children to have a dad. So you have to think through, what are the possibilities, what are the ways that if I do leave with the children, how can dad see the kids in a safe way? And there are so many ways to think about that. You just have to think about it beforehand. For some people, dad's mom, so the paternal grandmother, can be a wonderful person to sort of exchange the kids, pick up the kids from mom's new place or some public place and bring them to dad. Or just the school, having exchanges happen at the school, as long as everyone's aware of what's going on.
Okay. Well, let's get down to some of the more nuts and bolts. What can a domestic violence victim do in the criminal law? And then the follow-up question is going to be, what can a domestic violence victim do on the civil, non-criminal side? Well, let's start first with the criminal law. What can a victim do there?
Well, she can, if there is a recent incidents of violence, she can call the police. And if the police come and investigate and determine who the predominant aggressor is, that's the language that they use in the code, who is the batterer, the police themselves can ask for an emergency protective order from the magistrate. And that would also include issuing a warrant for the arrest of that person, which is an arrest for assault and battery of a family or household member. Now, the victim herself can do that. She doesn't necessarily have to call the police to do that. She herself can go to the magistrate's office and ask for an emergency protective order. Now, that is a limited type of relief. It only lasts 3 days. It only protects against contact, further family abuse, and gives the victim exclusive possession of the home. It's on a temporary basis for those 3 days. So that's one thing that can happen. That sort of starts off the criminal process, and then there would be an arraignment for this charge of assault and battery of a family or household member, and the victim would be the complaining witness.
Now, you mentioned the emergency protective order, and that's beginning to sound like the civil side, but you said that only lasts for 72 hours. So what else could the victim do on the civil side, in addition to the emergency protective order?
Well, the other thing she can do, either after or during the period when the emergency protective order is active, or instead, is go straight to Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court, JNDR Court, and ask for a preliminary protective order. Again, this is an emergency type of relief. She's saying, an injury happened, I'm scared of further family abuse. And that protective order, again, it would most likely be her asking for it, going to the intake office, working with the clerks, filling out an affidavit, and asking for that preliminary protective order before a judge. And most likely the abusive partner would not have been served. He wouldn't be there. It would be what's called an ex parte hearing. She's the only one there. and that lasts for 15 days. That gives her the same relief as an emergency protective order, no contact, no further family abuse, exclusive possession of the home, but it also gives her some other relief. For example, it can give her temporary exclusive possession of a jointly owned car or a car that's just in her name alone, which is a big deal for people, especially in our metropolitan Richmond area where people live in one part of the town and work in another part of town. We don't have a very great public transportation system. Getting around with a vehicle can be very important to a victim's safety. So that's one thing, and that would last, that civil process, the preliminary protective order lasts for 15 days. During that 15 days, the batterer or respondent is going to be served with the protective order, the preliminary protective order rather, and then, you know, the notice of the hearing for what's called the full protective order. And during that hearing, she can ask for relief for up to 2 years. And she gets the same relief that we talked about, but it can also address visitation. She can ask for temporary child support, temporary custody. She can even ask for temporary spouse's support in a full protective order. The key is she has to have asked for all of those things in her original petition when she filled it out with the clerk's office. She doesn't ask for things in the beginning. It's very hard to make the argument, oh, wait a minute, now that I'm here at the hearing, I forgot to ask for this, that, and the other.
So would you recommend to a victim that from the beginning she file and ask for pretty much every possible form of relief, the emergency protective order, the preliminary, the permanent, and ask for all of those other things you mentioned, custody support, spousal support, visitation?
I would recommend that, but I have to say that with a caveat. It really depends on the circumstances of the situation. If the victim feels like those are not things that they need to address right now, that they could work out custody and visitation with the children without asking for it, and that, frankly, if she asks for it, it might further endanger her. That's a key thing to remember. A protective order, it can be helpful to some people, but for some people, it can actually precipitate further family abuse. You're sort of, from the victim's point of view, she might be saying to her abuser, I'm standing up for you, I'm bringing other people into our relationship to help me. And that can endanger her more. It really depends on the circumstances and the particular dynamics of the parties.
It sounds like this is definitely not a one-size-fits-all type of situation.
Exactly, it's not. And there, I mean, the one... If the person does think that a protective order might be helpful for her, the one thing that a full protective order gives is what's called catch-all relief in the statute. It basically is, if you can make an argument for why you need it to protect yourself and or your children from abuse, make it, and you may be able to get it. So it could be things like, for example, one of the other issues I forgot to mention that you can get from a preliminary protective order as well as a full protective order is if the batterer has turned off your utilities, necessary utilities to the house. So here you have exclusive possession of the house, but you don't have any electricity and your lights are out and you can't cook, etc. You can order him to either restore those necessary utilities or never turn them off if he hasn't already. But you can get ask for him to be able to come with a third party to come pick up his stuff so that there's, you know, other people available. It's not just you and the batterer when he comes to pick up his things, which can be a dangerous situation in and of itself.
Well, so Sheila, thank you so much for being on the show. That's a very useful, informative discussion of a very complex legal issue and very complex emotional issues as well. Thank you for sharing with us.
Thank you.
Keep on talking, marching.
We're back with the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's independent radio.
This week's top three tips are about protective orders. The first tip is to ask for a protective order right after the abuse. If you wait more than 72 hours to ask, your chances of getting the order go down. The second tip is to ask for the permanent order in addition to the emergency order. The permanent order can last up to 2 years, but the emergency order lasts only 72 hours. The third tip is to follow through on each request for a protective order. If you don't follow through on one request for a protective order, your chances of getting a protective order if you abuse in the future go down. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King. And for this week, that's our top three tips.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. Also, if you have a question you would like answered on this show, email that question to marty@cvlas.org with radio show question in the subject line. Please include your name and phone number. You also can leave that same information before 8 a.m. or after 6 p.m. by calling 200-6045. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Everyone needs a home, but what do you do if you're facing eviction? With the housing crisis worsening, you can't afford not to know. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when our guest, Attorney Jim Nagles, explains the eviction laws in Virginia and how tenants can best protect themselves. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegmeyer.